Saray had never had an easy time of surrendering the past. Every time she cleaned and folded and put away a set of Rachel's outgrown baby clothes, she had shed secret tears that Saul somehow knew about. Saray had treasured every stage of Rachel's childhood, enjoying the day-to-day normalcy of things. A normalcy which she quietly accepted as the best of life. She had always felt that the essence of human experience lay not primarily in the peak experiences, the wedding days and triumphs which stood out in the memory like dates circled in red on old calendars, but rather in the unself-conscious flow of little things. The weekend afternoon, with each member of the family engaged in his or her own pursuit, their crossings and connections casual, dialogues imminently forgettable, but the sum of such hours creating a synergy which was important and eternal. Saul found Saray in the attic, weeping softly as she went through boxes. These were not the gentle tears once shed for the ending of small things. Saray Weintraub was angry. "What are you doing, Mother?" "Rachel needs clothes. Everything is too big. What fit on an 8-year-old won't fit on a 7-year-old. I have some more of her things here somewhere."
"Leave it," said Saul. "We'll buy something new."
Saray shook her head.
"And have her wonder every day where all of her favorite clothes have gone? No, I've saved some things. They're here somewhere.
Do it later."
"Damn it, there is no later,"
shouted Saray, and then turned away from Saul and raised her hands to her face.
"I'm sorry."
Saul put his arms around her. Despite the limited Poulsen treatments, her bare arms were much thinner than he remembered. Knots and cords under rough skin. He hugged her tightly.
"I'm sorry," she repeated, sobbing openly now. "It's just not fair."
"No," agreed Saul, "it's not fair." The sunlight coming through the dusty attic panes had a sad cathedral quality to it. Saul had always loved the smell of an attic, the hot and stale promise of a place so underused and filled with future treasures. Today, it was ruined. He crouched next to a box. "Come, dear," he said. "We'll look together." Rachel continued to be happy, involved with life, only slightly confused by the incongruities which faced her each morning when she awoke. As she grew younger, it became easier to explain away the changes that appeared to have occurred overnight. The old elm out front, gone. The new apartment building on the corner where M. Nesbitt used to live, in a colonial-era home. The absence of her friends. And Saul began to see, as never before, the flexibility of children. He now imagined Rachel living on the breaking crest of a wave of time, not seeing the murky depths of the sea beyond, keeping her balance with her small store of memories and a total commitment to the 12 to 15 hours of now allowed her each day. Neither Saul nor Saray wanted their daughter isolated from other children, and it was difficult to find ways to make contact. Rachel was delighted to play with the new girl or new boy in the neighborhood. Children of other instructors, the grandchildren of friends, for a while with Nikki's daughter. But the other children had to grow accustomed to Rachel greeting them anew each day, remembering nothing of their common past, and only a few had the sensitivity to continue such a charade for the sake of a playmate. The story of Rachel's unique illness was no secret in Crawford, of course. The fact of it had spread through the college the first year of Rachel's return, and the entire town knew soon after. Crawford reacted in the fashion of small towns immemorial. Some tongues wagged constantly. Some people could not keep the pity and pleasure at someone else's misfortune out of their voices and gazes. But mostly, the community folded its protective wings around the Weintraub family, like an awkward mother bird shielding its young. Still, they were allowed to live their lives,
and even when Saul had to cut back classes and then take an early retirement because of trips seeking medical treatment for Rachel, the real reason was mentioned by no one. But it could not last, of course. And on the spring day when Saul stepped onto the porch and saw his weeping 7-year-old daughter coming back from the park, surrounded and followed by a pack of newsteeps, their camera implants gleaming and comlogs extended, he knew that a phase of their life was over forever. Saul jumped from the porch and ran to Rachel's side. "M. Weintraub, is it true that your daughter contracted a terminal time illness? What's going to happen in 7 years? Will it just disappear?"
"M. Weintraub, M. Weintraub, Rachel says that she thinks Rabin Dowell is Senate CEO, and this is the year AD 2711. Has she lost those 34 years completely, or is this a delusion caused by the Merlin sickness?"
"Rachel, do you remember being a grown woman? What's it feel like to be a kid again?"
"M. Weintraub, M. Weintraub, just one still image, please. How about you get a picture of Rachel when she was older, and you and the kids stand looking at it?"
"M. Weintraub, is it true that this is the curse of the time tombs? Did Rachel see the Shrike monster?"
"Hey, Weintraub, Saul, hey, Solly, what are you and the little woman going to do when the kid's gone?"
There was a newsteep blocking Saul's way to the front door. The man leaned forward, the stereo lenses of his eyes elongated as they zoomed in for a close-up of Rachel. Saul grabbed the man's long hair, which was conveniently tied in a queue, and flung him aside. The pack brayed and bellowed outside the house for 7 weeks. Saul realized what he had known and forgotten about very small communities. They were frequently annoying, always parochial, sometimes prying on a one-to-one level, but never had they subscribed to the vicious legacy of the so-called public's right to know. The web did. Rather than have his family become permanent prisoners to the besieging reporters, Saul went on the offensive. He arranged interviews on the most pervasive Farcaster cable news programs, participated in all-thing discussions, and personally attended the Concourse Medical Research Conclave. In 10 standard months, he asked for help for his daughter on 80 worlds. Offers poured in from 10,000 sources, but the bulk of the communications were from faith healers, project promoters, institutes and freelance researchers offering their services in exchange for the publicity, Shrike cultists and other religious zealots pointing out that Rachel deserved the punishment, requests from various advertising agencies for product endorsements, offers from media agents to handle Rachel for such endorsements, offers of sympathy from common people, frequently enclosing credit chips, expressions of disbelief from scientists, offers from Holly producers and book publishers for exclusive rights to Rachel's life, and a barrage of real estate offers. Rikes University paid for a team of evaluators to sort the offers and see if anything might benefit Rachel. Most of the communications were discarded. A few medical or research offers were seriously considered. In the end, none seemed to offer any avenue of research or experimental therapy which Rikes had not already tried. One fatline flimsy came to Saul's attention. It was from the chairman of Kibbutz Kfar Shalom on Hebron, and read simply, "If it becomes too much, come."